Hello and welcome to this week's The Proteomics Show. This is our fourth season, which we are calling our B-side series.
Hi, I'm Ben Osborne, and I'm here with Dr. Benjamin Neely, and this episode features Julia Scheszener, who's a graduate student at the Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry in Munich.
Yeah, we got to meet Julia in person, but then we got to have her on the show. She does some really cool work, spatial proteomics, actually looking at like dynamic organelle maps. Really cool. Also, we got to talk with her about her life story and kind of where she's going. So enjoy. All right. Hello. Good morning, Julia. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So we both, Ben and I, met you in Winterberg, Germany at the UBIC conference in January. The reason that we're talking to you is you put your name in the hat to be on the show. We didn't pull your name out, but we thought you were such a like a good sport, you know, and you sounded like someone who should be on the show. So now, not live or in person, we're talking to you. So real fast, where are you like in the world? Geographically.
I'm in Munich in Germany.
Cool. How's the weather?
Pretty nice today. The last 2 days were a bit wonky, but today's good.
Cool. Yeah, I think we've only had a few international, as in like we've done this across the pond guests. All right, cool. So we'd like to, so first off, yeah, thank you again for volunteering and then also for coming back on. So we'd like to start this off, you know, just real briefly, if you wanted to talk about kind of what you do scientifically, you know, however much you want.
Yeah, so what I do is I'm currently doing my PhD still, or rather wrapping it up at the moment, and I'm working on spatial proteomics. So my PI has actually developed a method to portray the whole subcellular organization of the proteome in one experiment. It's called dynamic organelle maps, and essentially my PhD was about applying that to different kinds of biological questions and also developing the method. And during COVID, I pretty much switched from wet lab work to dry lab work. So now I'm a pure bioinformatician and writing up my thesis.
Okay. Can you go into how this how the dynamic organelle mapping works?
Yeah, sure. So it works in a way that you collect your cells, be that cell culture or tissue or whatever, really. And you do a gentle cell lysis where you first put the cells into an hypoosmotic buffer, so they swell a bit and the cytoskeleton gets a bit loose and so on. And then you just put them in a Downs homogenizer, and that will just crack open the cells. So no detergents, no nothing.
Wait, a what homogenizer?
A Downs homogenizer. That's just like a mortar and pestle, but okay. In a fancy scientific way.
I didn't know what this is. I got to look it up. Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. So it's essentially just forcing the cells through a defined clearance, through a narrow space to just crack them open. And then we just apply a differential centrifugation gradient. So you put your cell lysate into a tube and do spins at increasing speeds and collect the pellets. And across these pellets, you'll get a characteristic profile for each of the organelles. So, for example, mitochondria are rather dense. They will come down at very low spin speeds, whereas things like lysosomes are rather small and not so dense, and they come down in later fractions.
And are you using like Percol or some sort of a gradient material for that?
No. That's the beauty of it. You don't need any sucrose. It's like that. That's our competitors essentially who do either detergent gradients or sucrose gradients or something like that. You really just need differential centrifugation, and we also only collect 6 fractions, and that makes it super robust. So like we don't have the best resolution in terms of being able to say okay. This organelle is in that fraction, and this organelle is in that fraction, and that's it. But our method is super robust, so we can easily do it comparatively.
Okay, yeah, because I've done the Percol
or Phycol, secret, like where you like have to pour it.
Gradients
are rough.
Okay, I'm gonna pull layer number 3 that I can just barely see out of this, and then it's completely can't contaminate with this sticky goo and. Yeah. Yeah, no reproducibility.
Yeah, I've actually never done any gradients, so but I've heard stories from people who did it, and
I did it a ton in grad school.
Did you have the thing that poured the gradient? We had one of those in my postdoc. Like it was like a, it was like red and black and it, I don't know, it, but it was like made to like pour the gradient for you. So you weren't like layering your, you know, with
all this time, like making sure the specific gravity was all right or something, and the density was correct. And it was when you're mixing it and then the next ultra centrifugation thing, it might be like that the layer you're looking for is like a centimeter lower. This sounds really cool though.
Yeah, for us the issue is more to get enough material to still be able to see the pellets. So otherwise you're just left with a seemingly empty tube and you have to believe in the centrifuge that there is actually a pellet that you're trying to wash off the tube with SDS.
So how much material do you start with? Like we talked about?
Done as little as like a 10 centimeter cell culture dish. So that's perfectly sufficient. You can try to go lower, but then you really start not to see the pellets. And then it becomes pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So when you get these like fractions and you said, you know, there's only six and you're like, I have to figure things out. I mean, are you doing it by like markers? Are you doing actual like SEM or TEM to look at stuff? Or would you even? I guess that doesn't make any sense, right? You wouldn't need to image it. You're going by like markers.
Yeah, we're just going by markers. Yeah, so that's the whole idea behind it, that in the end you have a set of marker proteins for the different organelles, and then you can, like, we have a list of 1,000 or so, and then you can just run machine learning classification to assign all the other proteins to all the organelles.
Nice. And I guess once you validate it once, you know, you said it's robust, so now you just trust that that works. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That makes doing subcellular proteomics seem a little less daunting, right?
Yes.
A lot more open. Wow. Okay.
What's your final spin? Is it like 150,000, 2 hours, or like what's like your final spin?
So the final spin, I think in G forces, it's 80K.
Okay. So that's not. Yeah. Insane.
That's not so bad. It's a half an hour.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. No.
Cool.
So you don't have to. You don't need a centrifuge that operates under vacuum or anything for a speed that high or
nothing like that.
Wow. That's super approachable.
Yeah.
But now you're bioinformatics though.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a whole host of problems with the downstream data analysis. You have with any kind of profiling experiment, you always have to be careful about your data coverage and your missing data points and so on, and deciding which data to use and to trust. So I've played around with that a lot and essentially put the whole workflow for dynamic organelle maps into a graphical user interface. So if you do that kind of experiment, you can now just upload your results file from your search engine there and get your SVMs done and get your comparative analysis done and get your quality filtering.
Sorry. Oh, cool. Is that live now or is that part of the thesis?
That's been published last year.
Okay. Yeah.
That's part of a biological project that actually went into Nature Comms.
Okay.
What's the acronym? Because you sent me this paper and I looked at it. It's not DDoS. It's, oh my gosh, say what it is, the acronym.
DOMIBC.
That's it.
Or DOA. Analysis, Benchmarking, and Quality Control.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love our acronyms, right?
Need more.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to look for that because it seems like, okay, and now there's a GUI, so, and no per call, right?
Yeah.
That seems a whole lot.
Sold.
That was the goal of that specific piece of bioinformatics, to make it more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of informatics, like what languages are you writing in?
I'm writing in Python. I also can, in principle, do R. Like that's what I learned first in my bachelor's. But I don't really use it anymore.
Yeah. So what was your formal training for informatics? Like, did you put that up in grad school?
Yeah, so I did an undergraduate program called Molecular Biotechnology. That's one-third bioinformatics right from the start.
Okay.
So it's like three major areas that are covered, and one of them is bioinformatics. So I learned R in my third semester in my undergrad studies. But I only learned Python during my PhD.
And I would say, you know, there's always this, and I've kind of fluctuated across my career. I mean, I guess I definitely started, you know, like literally in the field and then the wet lab. And I have had these moments where I was just like just coding. That was only really 2 or 3 years. But I feel like that's a really big advantage, right? I mean, even if you, for some reason, got out of coding and you do lose it, right? I mean, it, you know, you have to, it's like a language, so you can, like, you won't be as good, but you'll always be able to read and understand and then also talk to people. But then you can also talk at the other side. I feel like people are always trying to get what you have, right? They want to be either a comp person with some wet lab experience or a wet lab person with, you know, some decent comp chops. And I mean, do you feel that, I don't know if you planned it this way, but do you kind of feel like you're pretty happy with this like skill set, this like roundedness, or?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with that skill set. I didn't plan it. I never wanted to let go of either wet lab or dry lab work. Like, yeah. I think there isn't a single proper project I've done where I haven't used both. So my next step will be trying to do bioinformatics only, and we'll see how I fare with that. It is a very rounded skill set. On the other hand, there will always be a specialist who can do things better than I can. So it's really about bridging between those two groups. That I think that's where the big benefit is.
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm, I mean, to speak about me, like I don't feel like I'm the best at either, but being able to talk to both, I think is very useful. Yeah, I 100%, I mean, I feel pretty worthless at most. It's that what's the, you know, not, what was it, the something of something, master of none? That's where my brain is. But yeah, no, I think it sounds really cool. And so you are thinking kind of that next step is see how the pure dry lab works out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's got benefits. Well, here, let me, this is kind of a part because we're kind of touching on it. We like to switch to how you got here. You know, like, and you don't have to go back to, you know, I was 6 years old and playing with, you know, I reprogrammed my Atari to like sequence a genome, but
didn't do anything like that.
You know, at some point we're going to have someone on. It's going to be like, yeah. It's going to be like, and one of these.
And as you're completely dating yourself, Ben, by with an Atari reference, right?
There weren't genomes back then either. I'm like blended
Julia by a decade or more.
But yeah, tell us kind of, yeah, how'd you get into science? How'd you get into, you know, you talked about wet lab. Yeah, how'd you get there? However much you want.
So my mom was actually in I have to think about how to say that in English. Medical documentation. So she was actually supervising doctors when they conducted clinical trials. So I did have some understanding for how to work scientifically just by watching her work. And I wanted to do something in the medical field, but I didn't want to become a doctor. So I just went for the most interdisciplinary thing out there that I could find and started studying that.
And can you, I mean, so wait, where are you, since we kind of like hopped around, so where are you from?
I'm actually from Munich.
Okay.
I was born and raised in Munich, then went to Heidelberg for studying, and now I came back for my PhD. I haven't gone very far in the world.
You know, and Ben and I both, I think, are on the same page on this one. Like I'm from the southeastern United States, and then I came to Charleston. I've been here now 20 years. So I went to grad school, postdoc, staff scientist, new job. And I know that's not normal and sometimes not even looked favorably, but after doing it, I strongly recommend it, right? Like there's a lot to be said for having some roots and in knowing a place and having all those like other life benefits that translates into a lot of quality of life. I don't know if, you know, that's the reason or if it just kind of happened that way. But
so the part of the reason for coming back was actually family. Now I definitely want to stay because of family. And I'm hoping to make it work. I mean, Munich has enough different institutes that you can still have different entries on your CV. Like, I don't have to be at the same institute for my whole career. I can just switch between universities and still stay in the same city.
Yeah, that's handy. I think there's like, I always joke, there's one Benelli job where I live. And so if it goes away, like, I'm in trouble. but it's not like a Boston or maybe a Seattle where you can, or a San Diego where you can, or yes, the Bay area where you can bop around. So Munich is kind of like that.
Yeah.
Cool.
So what's the plan? Are you looking at industry, or are you thinking following academic routes?
At this point, I would like to follow the academic route. Because I like this scientific way of working, and I also like my freedom in what projects I do as long as they get funded. I'm not so sure about industry, but honestly, if academia doesn't work out, I'm also not heartbroken if I have to go to industry. So I think it's important to not be too single-minded about this, because otherwise it anyway won't work.
What's your timeline like? I mean, maybe this is your informal CV here.
you mean my timeline for the future, or
yeah, when are you wrapping up? When is defense planned?
So my defense is planned for June, and I already know that I'll essentially stay in the same department for at least a year as a postdoc.
Okay.
And I'm like, essentially, Matthias is waiting for me to get on board on all these projects that are waiting for me.
Go, Ben, again, sorry.
Yes, who? Matthias who?
Matthias Mann.
Okay.
It could be Wilhelm.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, that is when we drop those names, I do kind of get confused.
Probably has need of some informatics here and there.
Yes, indeed. Although in the department, it's a bit different from probably many other departments with wet lab, because almost everybody codes. Like, I think there's only a handful of people who really haven't written a single line of code. But like, everybody crunches their own data and does their own visualizations and so on.
It's kind of surprising, honestly, because you know, a lot of times these big labs end up getting very segmented, where there's someone doing more of the really miserable sample preps and someone doing the operation. And so
no, everybody just does like a part of everything.
Yeah,
and I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And you know, I've heard, you know, that name. Like, I feel like maybe he's going places. I don't know. Sorry, we're making bad jokes. But like you said, like going back, you know, not being tied to something. I, you know, if we go back to the idea of like, if you want to stay somewhere, I mean, I do think it requires that openness, right? You know, you have to be able to take opportunities, but also kind of roll with the, you know, whatever life deals you. Mm-hmm. I always joke that I feel like my next opportunity would be like flipping burgers. I'd rather not do that, but I feel like I would do almost anything now to stay here. Like, I would be mm-hmm. sad, but you know, it's worth it.
Yeah. So that's kind of it for me. Like, if academia doesn't work out, in a way that it works well with the rest of my life, then I'm happy to go to industry.
Yeah. It's again, I hope it works well for you, but I do feel, to me, there's a calmness to it. Like there's, you know, you're not just trying to like advance up this chain and maybe do things that, you know, you don't like, I don't want to go certain places. But if you're just like, but if the goal is, and again, I'm speaking myself, but if my goal is just to be in a place, it seems like my choices are simplified. My goals are focused. It makes me like, I remember the moment that I made that transition and my brain just kind of calmed down. I mean, I still kind of lose my brain. I mean, Ben knows how calm I'm like, I'm losing it, but it's calmer. I do feel it.
Yeah.
So I hope the same for you.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I guess Ben, I'm going to steal your lead in here. The other thing is, like, you know, so you're obviously writing your dissertation. I remember that time in my life. It was hard. It was really hard. What do you do when you're not, you know, coding and sciencing? Like, what's the rest of, what do you do on your free time?
The rest of my life is currently pretty much my family, because I have a small daughter. So usually my day is writing and then spending time with her and then putting her to bed and then trying to find the energy to continue writing.
I mean, first off, I don't know how you do that. Like, I was worthless, as you know, like a late 20s, no obligations person. And here you are. Like, so we met you, like, she's not very old, right? I mean, this is like,
I passed 30, but I'm still.
No. How, your daughter? No.
Ah, sorry. My daughter is turning 2 in May.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, because we talked about that when we met you. And yeah, I don't know how you work that. What was it? We just had Olga on, Olga Vitek. And she also had kids in grad school. And it was funny because she's like, I don't know if that was the right choice because it was hard. But she's like, it's never a good choice. And she's happy with that choice. But again, like, I'm like some dude, I don't have obligations and it was still hard. And now you're doing this. And I feel like it's a lot.
It is a lot. And we also thought that maybe it's not the best time. On the other hand, it's never a good time. And I actually started talking to people in academia who have kids about this very early on. And like almost all of them said, if you want to do it and if you can time it, do it while you have to write something, because that's something you can do whenever. Don't do it while you have to do wet lab work. So that's what I did. So essentially we decided, like, at the point where COVID was over-ish and I was only doing bioinformatics, like, if there's a time, it's now.
I feel like my brain wouldn't work. I mean, I got to be upfront. Like, I feel like ever since children, my brain barely works. I get maybe 2 hours of brain per day.
I had serious baby brain. Like, during pregnancy and early after it, my concentration wasn't where it was before. And I was trying to do revisions for a paper.
Oh, man. So how does Germany treat that, or how does the school treat that? Did you get a semester off, I hope? Or
yeah, so Germany, or maybe rather the whole of Europe, is very different from the US there. So we get maternity leave, and that's actually obligatory. So, like, nobody can stop me from taking it. And that's 6 weeks before and 8 weeks after birth. And, like, the 6 weeks before, they are optional. But the 8 weeks afterwards, I'm actually not allowed to even work. In terms of the graduate school, like, they didn't care at all. Like, they just postponed my... So we have a thesis advisory committee, and they have to meet at a regular interval. And they just said, okay, we put a halt on that timer for the next reminder. And you tell us when you want to continue, and then we'll put it back on your schedule. And otherwise, luckily I'm not on a stipend, so I'm on a regular working contract. So yeah, that's also very different here. So you have all kinds of protection that you're not allowed to be, like, your contract is not allowed to be canceled while you're pregnant. The MPI also, like the Max Planck Society, also has a very good policy on extending contracts. If you took parental leave.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's very different than the U.S.
Yes.
I did not qualify for a single day of paternity leave.
Oh, wow.
My son was born at the very, very historic and Johns Hopkins Medical Institute. I didn't qualify for a single day.
Yeah, to me that just sounds completely crazy. Like,
And my wife had saved up vacation time for years, you know, in preparation. So that she could have time and
you can't even do that here, because you have to take your vacation days within a year, because otherwise, like, they don't really fulfill their purpose.
So it's very different.
I feel like we're getting it wrong. It's pretty obvious. we're not doing it right.
Yeah. But wow.
A friend of mine actually moved to the US and had a baby there, and they're both scientists, and they were really struggling to make that work somehow. In the end, they had to take the baby to the lab sometimes, because they didn't. They couldn't afford childcare really, and also didn't get any time off. Like, they had expected some leniency in academia compared to industry, but no.
Yeah. Nope.
and that's, you know, I always think about, you know, survivor bias is like a big thing. So as we talk to these people, like for the show, like we've obviously talked to like an Olga, a Ying, you know, these people that did this. But like, how many people, like, they're like, nope, you know, that was the end of basically probably the career, you know, because again, you make life choices, and that's, you know, what you're doing on this earth. Like, you have to make the choices for life, but it's really messed up. And you know, it's great to hear. I feel like we should, you know, more Europeans, it seems like that should be manifesting, right? Like, we should see like more diversity eventually, like going up the chain, I hope. I worry that that's maybe probably not going to happen here, because it's got to select for certain choices.
Actually, a big part of it was like of making it work was Matthias Mann, because he's very supportive. And we actually had a big baby boom in the department after COVID. Like, I think there were 6 people or so getting a kid in the same year, and there are actually several female group leaders that emerged from his department with kids, who are now very successful by themselves. So yeah, wow. If you want to interview them, I can give you their names later.
That's super cool.
That is great.
Always good to hear that someone that's a scientific inspiration is also, you know, a good person.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think at the single cell proteomics meeting in Vienna, I met someone who worked for Matthias Mann who had a small child, Florian, mm-hmm. Good speaker. So, and I wasn't sure if he was in Munich with you guys or was at there's another location, right?
There's two Florians at least.
Yeah.
So,
Okay. So I have to ask something not completely on topic. And if we've already done this on the show, I'm just going to apologize to anyone who actually listens. You do things when you graduate. There's like a hat. There's like a cart. Which of these things are you doing?
We're doing the hat.
Okay. Tell us about the hat.
So the hat in the so this depends a bit on where you are and also what customs the PI kind of enforces or taught to his students. So for us, the hat is usually a cardboard construction with several decorations on it relating to both your project and your hobbies and your family, probably in my case. So I'm sure there will be baby pictures of my daughter on there. And so usually the other PhD students in the department congregate before your defense and assemble that. And you can't actually wear it. Like, it's you have to hold it up on your head and just hold it there for people to take pictures. And then you put it somewhere in the corner because you can't actually wear it. It's either not stable or doesn't fit or it's just too heavy.
How long does it take to make? Go on. Wait, sorry, Ben.
I have trouble visualizing this. I'm gonna have to see a picture at some point. But
yeah. I mean, it does take like a few hours to make and a lot of preparation, like printing photos, ordering certain decorations, but we have like a whole closet in the department with just all the materials that you need to make that.
I love it.
The art of how you do this is sort of passed down through the generations of PhD students.
Wow.
It's like so much cooler than our sub. Okay, wait, the cart. Do you know what I'm saying about the cart? Like where you have to
Yes,
like
I
pull
know.
your advisor around?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I've actually only seen the cart while I was still in Heidelberg, and there it was actually the other way around. So the PhD student would sit in the cart, and their colleagues would push them around all the hallways, and
Maybe that's it.
they hand champagne to all their co-workers in the whole institute. But we don't do that at our institute.
Okay, I think that makes more sense. It wouldn't be like
Yeah.
the student pulling the advisor
I've never
around.
heard of that custom.
No, that's me misremembering. Like I said, we do nothing exciting here, right? It's just
Okay.
like defend, it's hard, drink champagne.
Okay. Yep.
Okay, thank you for
Okay. Yeah, no, I
clarifying.
had no idea this was a thing.
Right? It's so much cooler. Like I feel like we need so things we need to bring over from Europe. Obviously better parental leave and support. Graduation hats and or carts. Like
Vacation
we
time.
can do this. We can revolutionize American academia.
I would say prioritize the parental leave, though.
Oh,
I
you didn't say prioritize the hat. I mean, like the hat is key. Forget
mean,
the
the hat is
hoodie.
definitely easier to establish. That's true.
Yeah, no. These schools like their traditions of being very, very boring. They don't like to change things much either. So
I think they were just surprised
maybe it's
whenever any of
like,
us graduated.
yeah,
Like, I don't think
absolutely.
we had like traditions. They're like, oh, wow, you did it.
Oh man, I think not to belabor the point, but there was a in grad school. I remember what was just a turning point for me as a responsible person was the 5 minutes I had to walk back to my dog. To take care of it. And I just, like as Ben was mentioning, I just can't imagine myself as a graduate student with a child. I'm constantly as someone a lot closer to 50 than 30, like wondering how we are doing this. So no, absolute kudos to you for doing this.
It wouldn't be possible without home office either. Like, if I had to do wet lab work, it would be a whole different thing.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Okay, so my favorite part of the show is when I ask what you're most excited about in terms of where proteomics is going, or what the future is holding, from us for us.
Oh, I yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it really. I think it's really exciting that we can get deeper and deeper into the proteome. But I think we're probably gonna soon run into issues where we have to stop and think about what part of that data we actually still believe and what not. So I think making proteomics, like making these really deep proteomics methods robust enough that we can actually, for example, take them to the clinic and also maybe convince some people from other research areas to use it more. I think that's really what's still missing in the field, so to say.
Yeah, and it's funny how often that comes th those things kind of come up as an answer is right, like clinical and then reaching outside, and hopefully it seems like that's starting to happen, but it also sometimes feels very, very slow or less.
I remember when we first saw proteomics data while I was still in Heidelberg. Like I had no clue about proteomics. Like I had heard a theoretical lecture about it. That was like that lecture was that came with a ton of cautionary warnings about data interpretation. And when we first saw proteomics data from a collaborator, it was like, okay, what is this weird concept of an FDR? Why do you do this instead of just looking at p values? And like the whole department, like the whole group first had to grasp this concept and accept that it's correct and so on. And I think this tearing down that wall between people who do and get proteomics and people who've never done anything with it and are very skeptical, I think that's a big challenge.
Yeah, those are great answers, and I think those are things that we're all, the whole field, just struggling with all the time and happening.
Can you, but about on the organelles, because I mean, single cell, whatever, spatial, it's really cool. I love subcellular. I mean, what's that future? if you, I mean, what, like, where do you see that going or developing or the potentials? But just speak to that, because I'm interested in that.
Yeah, so I think it does have a lot of potential. There are currently some competing methods out there for how you do it. Some are, like, they all have the pros and cons for different applications and in terms of feasibility. I think one big thing that we always struggle with is validation. So whenever we predict the subcellular localization of a protein, we always get asked during revisions, okay, now validate that with IF, or show us that it's actually expressed with a Western blot. Especially if you do this comparatively, then the validation becomes a lot harder, because then you get the question, okay, show us that this thing actually moves by immunofluorescence. And then you have a protein that's just, according to your data, just moving within the Golgi apparatus, for example. And now show me how you do that, how you validate that by immunofluorescence. So I think that's one of the biggest issues that we have in this particular field currently, that, like, even if you trust the data, you always have to do orthogonal validation, and that's the bottleneck. So I think doing systematic studies on all kinds of biological things with subcellular organelle proteomics, that's doable. The problem is the validation.
I remember during my postdoc trying to get my advisor to let me slip through a very snappy comment about a Western blot being required by a reviewer. It's so funny that it's 2024 right now, and it's something that still continues to pop up. And I know we're about to deal with that ourselves. We're doing Western blots ahead of time, and just in anticipation that we need to do that. But, you know, maybe that's... sometimes I think that's what I'm most excited about, the future, when the mass spectrometer is trusted more than the rabbit blood.
Yeah.
Mass spectrometer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no. So, Julia, thank you so much for your time. I'm so glad that we got to catch up with you finally.
Yeah, thank you again for having me. I was a bit worried beforehand because I didn't really know what we would talk about and whether I would have anything interesting to tell you at all. But yeah, we filled the time. So
no, you were great, and I really do appreciate you making time. Yeah, so thank you. So this is the part. Yeah, so I got to read the credits. So first off, the views expressed are solely ours and not our employers. We want to thank Johannes Bagnoli for the song, Kaylee Kirkwood for the artwork. You can email us, our people, anyways, at theproteomicsshow@gmail.com. Please like, subscribe, stars, thumbs, and get us wherever you get podcasts. Thanks. Bye.